If there was ever a safe haven from the pounding logic of productivity, efficiency, and economic value in our Western capitalist society, you might think it would be the university campus. An academic redoubt of bright-eyed, earnest students passionately debating ideas, and professors lost in thought, pondering the fathomless mysteries of existence. Maggie Berg and Barbara Sieber would have you think otherwise. They describe academics as harried, stressed out, time-crunched, exhausted, and demoralized. Taking their inspiration from the slow movement, the slow food movement in particular, Professors Berg and Sieber have written a manifesto of sorts called The Slow Professor, challenging the culture of speed in the academy. They hope it will inspire their colleagues to reclaim the intellectual life of the university. Maggie Berg is a professor of English at Queen's University in Kingston, and Barbara Sieber is professor of English at Brock University in St. Catharines. Both have won awards for their teaching, and they're both with me in our Toronto studio. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Michael.
Good to have you with us. Before we want to clear up some confusion. The slow professors, that doesn't mean you talk very slowly in the classroom, does it?
That's right. I'm glad you cleared that up, Michael. That's a misconception, and we're teased about that all the time.
Really?
But by slow, we really mean being deliberate and reflective and making informed decisions about things rather than being frantic.
We're not... I think someone committed a Freudian slip, at least we hope it's Freudian, by calling us, the lazy professors.
Oh.
It's not about laziness. It's not about doing less. It's about, as Maggie said, it's about deliberation.
Can you describe for me what you call the culture of speed in the academy? What is it?
Well, I think the culture of speed has to do with, first of all, homogeneity, standardization. I mean, the same kind of thing that has happened in the shift from slow food or food that we, what used to be considered food, to fast food. And the same is happening in terms of knowledge production. So it's about having things that are transferable, that are impactful, and I'm using air quotes.
Yes, you are.
that will have quick results, that are easily measured. And I mean, how do you measure deep thinking?
Yeah.
How do you measure open-ended intellectual inquiry? So the very things that are at the heart of the university defy this kind of rubric of measurement.
Yeah,
sorry, can I just add there that Barbara and I see the culture of speed as being a direct consequence of the corporatization of the university, because the emphasis in the corporate university is on the product, the end product, on being, on educating people in a short time span. And it's putting pressure on all of us. So our argument is that it's specifically corporatization with its emphasis on the end product, on productivity and competition and the economic bottom line that has sped up the clock.
I want to get to that in a moment, but you use the phrase fast knowledge in the book. What is fast knowledge?
Well, we wrote one chapter each separately. Barbara uses that in the research chapter. But I think fast knowledge is really knowledge with a very specific end in sight.
And that end being?
Something that ideally, has an economic payoff.
A value to it.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So fast knowledge, I think, has to do with this idea that it's things that are directly applicable and measurable. And of course, we're not saying that applied knowledge isn't important. Of course it is. But there's a real danger with using that as the yardstick for everything because, I mean, I'm a Jane Austen person. How useful is Jane Austen? Well, I would say she's pretty damn useful, but I'm not going to get a grant to study Jane Austen by a corporation. So fast knowledge is about, it also has to do with tie-ins with other major corporations. And again, that imposition of an economic bottom line.
And I think that we're all, whether we're in the sciences or the humanities, we're all feeling the pressure of having to produce. And that's one of the issues with the corporate university is competition, competitiveness.
The corporate university is a phrase, it's gotten legs in the last 10, 15 years.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
which has meant, I take it, Maggie, is a diminution of the power of the faculty, the actual teachers, the professors.
I think so. I mean, what we've seen in the past 20 years, I think, is the ballooning of the administration in the university in order to try to remain economically competitive. So what happens is decisions are made frequently. Decisions are made in the top levels and passed down to the professors. But one thing that we do feel is, and this is why we wrote the book, is that individual professors still have power to mm-hmm. resist the homogenization that is happening.
If they have the will, they may have the power.
Yes, well, the will, if they're not too frantic.
Yeah.
I mean, and if we can actually make connections with one another, and that was mm-hmm. another reason mm-hmm. for writing the book.
You quote Benjamin Ginsberg in the book, who describes the administration of a typical university like this. Universities are filled with armies of functionaries, the vice presidents, associate vice presidents, assistant vice presidents, provosts, associate provosts, vice provost, assistant provost, deans, deanlets, deanlings, each commanding staffers and assistants who direct the operation of every school. That's extraordinary.
That's one of my favorite quotations from the book, so thanks for reading it.
Yes, and it gets a reaction every time we present that at a talk.
But that's common in universities, that administrations and administrative personnel have balloon.
And if I can add on to what Maggie was saying about, or the question you raised about the shift in power from mm-hmm. faculty to the management system, another huge part of corporatization is the casualization of labor, mm-hmm. which is, of course, happening not just in universities, but it's part of a corporate, system,
what
right?
What do you mean by that? The casualization.
Hiring sessionals for...
These are part-time instructors.
Which is, mm-hmm. of course, it's more, to use again, I'm using air quotes, cost-effective.
Because they don't pay very well.
That's right.
Yeah.
And they don't get the time to do the research. So the casualization of labor is great if the number one concern you have is about an economic bottom line. But if the bottom line is thinking about what's best for education, then casualization is not a good thing.
And what Barbara's calling the casualization of labor, or the increase in sessional instructors, is having one effect of emptying out the social life of the university, because people are trying to cobble together a living by traveling from job to job, and so they don't have time to spend in the university in which they're teaching.
What do you mean by the phrase, I wrote it down here, what we need to talk about the way we talk about time all the time?
Yes.
Do you talk about time all the time?
Yes. Every academic says they're too busy, they're busy, they're busy. And we make the point in the beginning of the book that there's a kind of pride in busyness, that busyness makes you seem important. And so people are always saying that anyway. So in a workshop that we gave quite early on, one of our colleagues actually said, I think we should start talking about time differently. But of course, it's difficult mm-hmm. when we're stressed.
Do you have the time to talk about time?
I do have the time. And I think we quote David Posen in his book, Is Work Killing You? He's a Canadian doctor. Mm-hmm. And he talks about being hired by corporations to go in and talk to their employees about time management, etc. And he's of the persuasion, as are we, that working effectively does not mean necessarily all the time working long hours. And then he says, though, that corporations are really resistant to that because there is a culture that celebrates overwork. There's kind of a machismo attached to, oh, I'm so busy, I'm so overworked, I've got so much to do.
David's an old friend of mine. I've known him for years, and he tells me that he has patients coming in, sitting down and saying, I don't know what to do with my life. I'm going crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And, and it's that way in the academia.
Yes, we loved his book, actually.
Yeah.
And I have to tell you something funny, that we really liked his point that there's a point when one is working at which diminishing returns set in. So that overwork doesn't produce quality work. And when Barbara and I would meet to write the book together, she would look at me hopefully and say, have diminishing returns set in? Because it would mean we could go and get lunch or something like that.
Slowly.
So, but he also says that he has difficulty persuading corporations of his viewpoint.
You write about this obsession with productivity and efficiency in the corporatized university. Mm-hmm. How does the administration expect or want you to be efficient and more productive? Do they monitor what you do? Or
Yes. There are. I mean, we're living in the era of accountability, right? There is still, I mean, that description that you read out about the professor, I mean, it made me smile so much because it's so deeply ironic. Yeah. You were describing what universities are not like anymore.
That's the ideal.
That's the ideal, yeah. Right? And so we're living in an era of accountability. And as Bill Redding says in his brilliant University in Ruins, accountability is actually a logic of accounting. We don't deny that we should be accountable.
In terms of your teaching.
Yes. And we should, you know, we have jobs with tremendous privilege. And, you know, we're not denying that. But the logic of accounting, the problem with that is it counts only certain things. There are certain things that are invisible in a logic of accounting. And because there is that logic of accounting, what happens is that we're being encouraged to stay away from the really big questions because they're going to take too long to think through, right? It's you want to pump out as much stuff as quickly as you can.
Stuff, yeah.
That's going to have a consequence for how thoughtful things are.
Can you give me an idea of how this question of productivity and economic value and all that kind of stuff, how does it affect you day to day? Does it affect your work in the classroom and dealing with students or?
I think it could if we didn't resist it. So one of the emphases in the corporate university is on the degree, on the piece of paper, the product, the course as product, the degree as a product. And I think that can have the result of us feeling really under pressure to deliver some kind of course content.
Is this akin to the pressure that we've heard about for years, this mantra of publisher perish?
There's that also, because we are accountable in the ways that Barbara described. We have an annual dean's report, and now the university is finding more standardized ways for faculty to report their activities.
Standardized.
And standardized means that everything becomes equivalent. So the humanities look particularly unproductive in relation to the sciences. Although,
why do we need Jane Austen? Is that the idea?
Well, and also, how many articles do we need to publish in a year? And what about people who want to spend time thinking about really difficult, open-ended questions? What about people who want to spend 10 years writing a book?
Okay, now let me ask you both. Is it possible in your respective university in Brock and Queens, say you wanted to spend an hour looking at one particular sentence in an essay or a poem or something, or you just wanted to sit back and noodle away on something that may not amount to anything. Is that possible, Barbara?
I guess the first thing I would say is that the book is not about Queens or Brock, because mm-hmm. we've been, you know, we're
sure.
very grateful for our jobs, and we both have, you know, very supportive colleagues and deans. So yes, I can still take that hour to ponder a sentence. But I think what it has affected, though, the overall system, and I guess maybe an anecdote that will demonstrate that, and we use it in the book, but it just happened again 3 weeks ago, where a student comes to see me to check her thesis statement with me and to talk about her essay, and I'm listening to the student, mm-hmm. and I can tell they haven't finished the novel. And I ask them, have you finished the novel? And they go, no, but I'm going to finish it over the weekend. And I have to explain that you can't really have a thesis statement about a literary text if you have not finished the novel. And these aren't bad students, because these are students who are coming to see me,
right.
which is a small segment of the student population right. who actually goes to office hours. But so that's another consequence of the idea of like how the corporate university and the stress is also affecting students. So yes, I can still take an hour to ponder a sentence. Many students are not doing that. They're not even finishing the books.
I agree with Barbara, but I'd like to give a slightly different perspective as well, because I think that the corporate university emphasizes that students just want the degree, that they're interested only in the piece of paper. And I find that that is not true in my classes. So I will spend an hour and a half on a poem in a class. Mm-hmm. And the students want to do that. They are keen to have real knowledge. They're keen to have open-ended questions. And above all, they want connection with their professors.
Yeah. Is that why you've written and you explore the idea of the difference between knowledge and understanding?
Yes.
What is the difference?
Understanding takes longer. It's the result of open-ended inquiry. It's based on questions. Mm-hmm. Knowledge is something that you can package.
And you get off the internet or Wikipedia something.
Even from a straightforward lecture where the professor isn't really engaged in what the students are thinking about. Or more and more, online courses. Online courses offer knowledge. It can be packaged.
I think most students, they are there for genuine learning. And I now make it part of my teaching practice to start each course with some reflection on what are we here to do at the university on a philosophical level, and the students really respond to that. So I think the students are caught, you know, they're having to do so much, but they want to be there for like the right reasons.
You use the word thinkology, which I have never seen before. What is thinkology?
I think thinkology, it's Bodil Johnson's term in Unwinding the Clock. And she came up with that term as a critique of how, again, corporatization is shaping the kind of intellectual work that is getting done. And she says that, you know, the kind of thinking that happens or should happen at university is different from an industrialized production. And so I think it goes back to what you're asking about the difference between knowledge and understanding. Knowledge seems to be something like, okay, you get it, and then you got it. To quote Virginia Woolf, mm-hmm. nuggets of truth you place on your mantelpiece forever.
Sure.
And understanding is something that unfolds, and it can deepen. And so hence, 20 years of working on Jane Austen still has lots to teach me. I still don't have her.
Is part of the purpose of a university education, and I'm asking this as someone who doesn't have one, credentialization, if that is such a word. You talk about a piece of paper, but the student does want that. You want the BA or the master's or whatever.
Yes, I mean, there is, of course, there's some knowledge involved in a degree. But we resist the emphasis on transferable skills. We're not suggesting that the skills we teach in an English department are not transferable. They are. So people come out being able to engage in critical thinking, being able to write well, express themselves well. But there are also skills, if you want to call them that, joys, actually, that are specific to the discipline, that involve enjoying the language, the beauty of the language.
And the beauty of the language teaches you how to think.
Yes, mm-hmm. that's right. That's so absolutely that's right. Mm-hmm. But thinking is open-ended.
My guests this morning, Maggie Berg, a professor of English at Queen's University in Kingston, and Barbara Sieber, professor of English at Brock University in St. Catharines. They're the co-authors of a book called The Slow Professor, Challenging the Culture of Speed in the Academy. A lot of people will say, and I will say it up front, that you folks have a secure job, well-paying job. Why should you be immune to all the time pressures and so on that the rest of us face?
Mm.
You stand indicted here.
That's right. Well, we recognize that we have privileges. We recognize that we have wonderful jobs where we are in control of our own time a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
We have benefits and a pension. There are two things that I would say, and I think I'm sure Barbara agrees. And one is that we think what we say about considering the principles of slow in our daily lives applies to other professions as well. We've had people from other walks of life telling us that they agree, they feel the same way, they feel rushed and harried and stressed, and they appreciate it.
We didn't write this book for ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, we're concerned about what is happening to academia in general, what's happening to the expectations for graduate students, what's happening in terms of the casualization of labor, what's happening to certain disciplines, which, you know, are much more under fire than other kinds of disciplines. I think open-ended inquiry is important across the disciplines, but certainly faculties like the humanities are having a more difficult time.
They're under siege, aren't they?
They're under siege.
In every university.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
In the way that other disciplines are not to the same extent. We have wonderful jobs, we understand that, but we're writing about the institution and we're writing about what is happening to, again, that principle of open-ended inquiry. And I think the other thing that's important about what we think is important is that the space for social critique is shrinking within the university because it's countercultural. And again, if the mandates for research are being set externally rather than driven by faculty, that has implications for what's happening to the space for feminist critique or social justice work.
All right,
work.
Well, let me pursue that with Maggie. Universities have huge classes in big lecture halls. Sometimes, is this true that sometimes the students may not have any contact with the professor? Is that?
Unfortunately, yes. I read some interesting research that came out of Britain showing that the source of student stress is lack of guidance from the professors and lack of connection with their professors.
Why is actual teaching in the classroom so important to this idea of the slow professor?
Frankly, for me, it's important because it's one realm in which I feel I have some power and some control. I can decide on how the course will be run and how my class will go. And I feel more comfortable in the classroom. And I also think that the classroom is a place in which, since we do feel we have some power, we can resist the powerlessness that we feel as a result of the increasing corporatization of the university. I mean, we all feel overwhelmed by it, and we feel powerless.
I've had talked to professors, though, on this program who say they look over a sea of student heads are down because they're on their phone or they're texting or they're looking at Google, whatever. Is that the case? Did you find that? Do you have control over that?
That's a really big issue. And I think, I mean, I am certainly very fortunate that the biggest class I'm teaching is 100 students.
It's 100 students in a class?
And I guess I think that's small compared to first year sociology or biology, which would be,
really?
You know, hundreds.
Mm-hmm. How do you know their name? You don't know their names.
I don't. I know some names. I mean, technology, right, it's a complex topic. It has brought a lot of good, but it is also, I mean, what I do on the first day of class, I put up a quotation from Sherry Turkle, who is a professor of technology at MIT, and I put it up on the PowerPoint, and she says, media literacy is not only about knowing how to use technology, but also when to use it. Mm-hmm. And I tell my students, you could teach me a lot about how to, I can teach you when not.
You quote a professor who says that we're training our brains to pay attention to crap.
Yes, that's right. Thomas Chatfield, in a book called How to Thrive in the Digital Age, points out that his most productive times for thinking are times when he's offline. In fact, I read his book on the train to Toronto one day, and I thought, this is an example of how wonderful it is to sit here and just think.
Well, describe a slow class or a slow, if you were teaching, like you said at one point in the book, a slow class, the time would go by so fast that students and professors would be surprised. Mm-hmm. How is that so?
That was Maggie.
Okay. Now you're on
the spot.
Well,
this is my ideal class, of course. It doesn't always work that way, right. I should point out. But I think because we're engaged in conversation, because we're talking to one another, and I do think that that's what students want. But I think that it's becoming increasingly difficult for faculty who are stressed and harried and distracted by all the administration and other tasks that we're juggling. It's becoming increasingly difficult for us to walk into the classroom and really focus on the material and the students. It's about making connections between us and our students.
Barbara, give me a sense of if you would go into a classroom and say, we were going to do this, but I want to do this. I want to spend an hour talking about something. What would the reaction be?
I think the students would welcome it.
Yeah.
Can you do it, given the time constraints, restraints that you have and all that?
Well, I think one of the things that we've both, you know, talked about a lot with each other is the idea that coverage can be rethought. Mm-hmm. Coverage does not necessarily mean cramming as many texts into a course as possible. It may mean teaching fewer literary texts, but spending longer on them. I think, again, that is something that we can do. We do have some control over our syllabi. Mm-hmm.
Do you have any sense from talking to your colleagues how much of the busyness and the overwork and all that kind of stuff taken by professors is, in a sense, a defensive reaction against the ivory tower charge?
I think it is, certainly. I mean, I think we say early in the book that we think that we're a culture of guilt and shame. I mean, we feel guilty because we know we have wonderful jobs. And then there's the myth of the lazy academic, which makes us defensive. And I think we also feel guilty if we're enjoying ourselves.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I love teaching. Yes. But we have to be very serious.
But I wonder how your fellow academics have responded to your manifesto.
I mean, we have been so incredibly overwhelmed in a really, really positive way by how generous people have been with us. And for me, my most favorite part has been people just writing to us, people we've never met. And
professors
and students and people in
parents? Do parents?
Not parents, but people also in other lines of work who have read the book and who expressed that it resonated. That has been wonderful, and we didn't expect that. I think there has also been a reaction of, and I like to think, well, they just haven't read the book, where people say, oh, well, that's all nice and dandy for you, but I have too many responsibilities. So I think there's also a misunderstanding of what slow means. And you're interested in the slow movement yourself. Like, so you're familiar with this idea that people just think, oh, it means like doing less, like just kind of checking out. And so sometimes people will say that, well, that's great, but you know, I'm chair of a department, so I can't do that. I think that's a misunderstanding of what slow philosophy is about.
Maggie, is the idea of the slow professor gaining any kind of traction, any kind of currency, going up against the fast corporate world in universities?
Well, so far we've been overwhelmed by the response. And I think that what it shows is that one of the things we wanted to do is successful in the book, and that is to get people to talk to one another about how they're feeling. The university emphasizes rationality and the pursuit of knowledge. And we talk in the book about how it feels to be in the context of the corporate university. So we emphasize emotions, we emphasize the body even when we discuss stress. And that's what people have responded to, I think. They've responded both to the emphasis on the emotions and to the fact that we're willing to talk about it. People have thanked us for saying these things.
But with the suit, the administrators, the vice deans and under deans and all those people, they look at you as revolutionaries?
No, I don't think so.
Really? You are. I think you're subversives.
But there are pockets of resistance throughout the university.
Yes.
We're not pointing our fingers at administrators. We want to make that clear. Because everyone's struggling under the cutbacks to make things work.
Yeah. And it is about a system. And I think, again, I would agree that there are pockets of resistance, I think, at every level of the university.
It sounds like, you make it sound like an occupied territory, and there are little groups of partisans.
That's true.
Resisting.
I hadn't thought of that image.
Well, one of the books that I love the most is Stefan Collini's book, What Are Universities For? And he talks about how corporatization has colonized our minds, and I agree with that. So I think that one of the things that we've tried, I think this is why people have responded, given for what Maggie said in terms of that we're talking about the emotions, we're talking about what it feels like. I think the other part of that is that there's a sense of optimism. Like, we don't believe it's too late.
Yes.
Whereas there's a lot of books out there that say, oh, it's over. Mm-hmm. And we don't think that. I mean, if we did, we wouldn't have written the book. We think there's lots of opportunities to make change.
Well, as the parent of two children in universities, I hope you're right. One of the things I liked about the book, it doesn't take long to read it.
Mm-hmm. That was deliberate.
That was intentional.
Is that right?
Yes.
So it's a thesis about slowness, but it's a fast read.
Yes.
Well, we didn't want a long tome that people had to plow right. through. Yes. Yes.
We want you to linger.
Indeed.
Yes.
And think about it.
Yes.
Delight to meet you on the radio. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Michael.
Good to talk to you.
Thank you.
Maggie Berg is professor of English at Queen's University in Kingston, and Barbara Sieber is professor of English at Brock University in St. Catharines. They're the co-authors of The Slow Professor, Challenging the Culture of Speed in the Academy. It's published by the University of Toronto Press. And this morning, they were with me in our studio in Toronto. You are listening to the Sunday edition across Canada on CBC Radio 1 and across North America on Sirius XM Radio. My name is Michael Enright.